Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this podcast, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. Welcome to episode 13 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Monday, June 26, 2017. It was absolutely thrilling to meet some of you at the Citizens Climate International Conference in Washington, D.C. earlier this month. I even bumped into Michael David Terungwa, one of the very first guests on our show. He traveled all the way from Nigeria to talk about the 17 climate groups he started in 12 African nations. I chatted with him and will share that interview with you in a future show. But let's talk about what you will hear on today's show. I have your answers to last month's puzzler question. This one was about the Arctic warming and why it's been such a big deal for climate scientists. In the Art House, we travel back to the future with Timothy Meadows and that day in climate history. Reporting from the year 2167, he reveals the pets of the future. And speaking of pets, I've been wondering, how are pets affected by global warming? How is pet care a climate issue? In today's episode, we explore the many ways pets and climate rub up against each other. You will learn how to protect your pet in a time of climate change. And for climate communicators, you will also discover how to talk to pet owners about our changing climate. To help with our conversation today, I've brought in an expert. Meet Dr. Steva Stoll Hardcastle. A veterinarian in rural central Pennsylvania, Steva works with both house pets and larger farm animals. Growing up, she spent summers on her grandparents' farm with a multitude of farm animals around her. Steva's mom also helped foster her love of animals.
Since my mom was a teacher, she guided what I watched on TV, you know, like Natural Geographic specials or Jacques Cousteau or, oh, what was the one? It was sponsored by Mutual of Omaha, Wild Kingdom. That's what it was. Jim, go out and wrestle that alligator.
Steva is not wrestling alligators, but her practice gets her in contact with all sorts of animals and their human companions. If you are a pet owner, you understand how much you give to your pet and how much you receive. Care, companionship, protection, entertainment. But as a veterinarian, Steva points out something else pets and humans give to each other. Diseases.
So we're probably one of the first line for what we call zoonotic diseases, which are diseases that pets can give humans or humans can give pets. I've seen ringworm. So that's a fungal disease. I've had it myself. I got it from a guinea pig. But most of the time, I'll have owners get ringworm from kittens, little stray kittens that they bring home, and they're cuddling them against their neck and kissing them and holding them, and by golly, what's that on my neck? Yep, ringworm.
Ew. Yeah, I can see how that can happen. I mean, kittens are insanely adorable. I'm actually shocked I haven't gotten ringworm already. Okay, so how can we human pet owners infect the animals in our care?
Well, we could give ringworm back. There are cases of certain types of bacteria on our skin that we can give to pets that can be resistant to antibiotics. And flu virus is pretty deadly to ferrets. So I always tell people, if you have a ferret, you know, and you're really not feeling well with a fever and you're dying, you know, don't go cuddling your ferret.
Who knew cuddling could be so dangerous? But what about climate change?
We're all in this together. And climate change, as it's affecting temperature, water availability, and weather patterns, affects humans and therefore affects their pets. But it also has an impact on our livestock and our food production, is a very important thing that many people don't think about.
In fact, as a veterinarian, Steva sees that climate change is already bugging our pets.
Pets are affected because of the type of insects and what we call arthropod vectors. So these are bugs, you know, whether it's a mosquito or a tick or, you know, various kinds of bugs that need warm weather to live in, or a certain type of humidity or moisture. Geographical patterns or where they live in the United States are expanding into places that they never lived before. So as veterinarians, we have to be aware that a disease that we never saw in Pennsylvania, we can now. Let's take ticks. And I'm going to use the Lone Star tick. And so most people, you know, what? Lone Star? What do we associate that with? Texas! You know, the Lone Star State. So Texas, the tick is called Amblyomma americanum. And it used to be distributed really just in the southern part of the United States. It is now moving up the East Coast. We're finding it here in Pennsylvania. It's going up the Mississippi Valley, up into the states, you know, lining those areas. And so the Lone Star tick carries Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and it carries a species of Ehrlichia, which are two diseases that our dogs can get. And so these diseases we may not have tested for some years ago, but now if we have a dog who's running a fever or showing certain types of clinical signs and we're not finding an answer with the common tests that we do, we may need to send out and do a more wide-ranging, what we call tick panel.
Steva told me about the Gulf Coast tick that originated in the southern states. This tick is moving north into Virginia, Oklahoma, Kansas, and has even been found in parts of Canada. The tick carries a nasty disease.
Patazonosis. There's no real cure for it. These dogs are on three different types of antibiotic kinds of medications, and then they have to take another medication for life, because part of this protozoan that's carried by ticks buries itself into the muscle of dogs, and so we can't get it out of the muscle. So we have to give drugs that once it leaves the muscle, we can attack it. But without diagnosing and treating it, dogs will be dead in a year from this disease. It's a horrible disease.
Warmer winters are also contributing to the increase of ticks and therefore the diseases they spread.
Ticks are not impeded by snow unless it's sustained and super, super, super cold. In fact, ticks kind of like snow, because just like people, you can bury into the snow and form a little snow igloo and it actually gives you a little bit of insulation. Ticks love a little snow. And the other thing that folks don't realize about ticks, they think about ticks being carried by, we're going to move to the deer tick, Ixodes, that it's on deer or just mice or chipmunks. But these ticks are carried by songbirds. You may have a mowed lawn, but if robins and other birds are landing in your yard, they're bringing ticks in.
Now that is a terrifying thought. To think that I sit in the park on a landing strip for ticks. And speaking of flying dangers, turns out mosquitoes are not only a dangerous nuisance for humans, they pester our pets too.
Well, mosquitoes affect pets in a variety of ways. They can carry a number of diseases, from West Nile virus, and we think about that being more on the horse side, but they also carry heartworm. And heartworm was once more of a Gulf Coast, up the Mississippi Valley, up kind of the East Coast into the Carolinas, but not so much coming up into the Northeast and other parts of the United States. Now, with increased water and flooding. We're seeing a nice host for mosquitoes. One of the things that has been talked a lot in the veterinary community was when Hurricane Katrina came through. People were displaced, obviously. Some were able to take their pets with them, but many not. So there were many, homeless, orphaned dogs that were rescued out of the South and then rehomed up in all over the United States. These dogs harboring heartworm disease, now being taken in cars and vans and redistributed all over the United States to new homes, thankfully, for the people who are willing to adopt them, but they're bringing in new diseases to their areas. And not only heartworm disease coming out, of these areas, but also intestinal parasites like roundworms and hookworms and other tick-related diseases as well.
It was in reading about Hurricane Katrina that I first began to consider pets and climate change. Author Dave Eggers wrote a lot about those pets left behind in New Orleans during Katrina in 2005. Forced to evacuate, pet owners faced a dilemma. Most emergency shelters, like homeless shelters, do not allow pets. So when a big storm hits, what do you do with your dog, cat, or other pets? Some people decide to stay at home with their animals and ride it out. Post-Katrina research reveals that nearly half the people who defied the evacuation ban did so in part to care for their pets. Still, many pet owners had to leave their pets behind. They believed the storm would pass quickly and they would return in a day or two. They left food out, left water, had the AC going. That's how it usually happened. But not this time. The levee broke, and the city flooded. People couldn't return. In Dave Eggers' book, Zaytoun, we hear the true story of a Syrian American who floated above the city streets in a canoe. He brought food and water to terrified, starving, and dehydrated animals trapped in sweltering homes without electricity. Thousands of pets died at home and on the streets, with their caregivers far away, unable to help. Of course, during that storm and the aftermath, there was more than just pets who were affected. Many humans suffered, lost their lives, and experienced so much trauma. And somehow it's the pet stories that strike many people. And if it gets them to better understand the dangers that we face during extreme weather events, then I think it's worth considering these pets. When I talk to animal lovers about climate change, I encourage them to find out about emergency shelters for pets. If they don't have one nearby, they can help organize emergency pet care in preparation for the more frequent and larger storms to come. In our conversation about pets, Steva also told me about extreme heat, which affects all of us, including our pets. Heat waves affect some humans more than others, particularly the elderly and the very young. Similarly, certain pets are especially vulnerable to extreme heat.
So any breed that is brachycephalic, and gosh, what does that word mean? Well, it's just a dog or a cat with a smushy face. So think of a bulldog, think of a Himalayan or a Persian cat, pugs, Boston Terriers. These pets have been bred to basically have no nose. And the nose actually plays an important function for all of us. It clears diseases, but it also helps cool us. So, air passing through the nasal passages, it's already starting to cool. So when you can't cool yourself very well, a hot or humid day can put you in risk for heat stress or heat stroke. And those breeds are the most prone. Never leave them outside in the sun. Don't go running or walking in the middle of the day. Have them inside, have air conditioning, a fan. Keep them cool with air moving over them because they can't sweat like we sweat to cool. They're going to cool themselves by panting And they will sweat through their foot pads. So cooling their foot pads and allowing, you know, a good panting with air circulation. Heat stress and heat stroke can occur in other breeds as well. I think about my dogs who love to play ball or frisbee or who go run with their owners. They will keep going even probably when they shouldn't. They're not going to tell you, hey, you know what? I'm getting a little warm here. We need to stop. They will keep running after the ball and playing frisbee until they really almost collapse. And we will see them come in shock with a temperature, you know, at 107, their normal temperature being around 101. And with heat, stress, and stroke, especially heat stroke, which is the more severe form, you can get brain damage, kidney damage. These dogs can die. It's a horrific death, and owners feel so guilty because they didn't see or understand what was happening. So we try to educate on that matter.
In a moment, Steva will give us advice for how we can protect our pets from the effects of climate change. But before she does, let's consider food. Pet food can get really expensive. Many folks want to give their pets the best possible food. On a warmer planet, we are going to see more droughts and floods. These will and are disrupting food production. As grain prices rise, so will meat prices. Human food will cost more, so will pet food. Steve explains, though, that even with higher prices, we will get less bang for the buck.
As heat rises, the nutrient value of the corn and the wheat decreases because of the stress of the heat and possibly lack of water. So if you're having a less nutrient-dense food ingredient going into the pet food or directly being fed to cattle, sheep, goats, you know, horse, they're not going to get the nutrition they need. And so if we're talking about food production on the cattle side, you know, the weight gain, the rapidness of the weight gain, the health of the cattle is going to be affected.
So what is a pet owner to do? Plenty. There's a lot you could do. Just like with all aspects of climate change, we are not helpless or hopeless. Every day, more and more people are educating themselves about climate change, and they discover how it affects something they cherish. In response, they are pursuing solutions, small and large. Steva already told us about the need to keep our pets from overheating. I asked her to share any other advice she has for pet owners during this time of climate change.
1 out of 9 pets in their lifetime will get lost, and most of those aren't found. So microchip your pet. And I highly recommend cats get microchipped as well, because we know when indoor cats get lost, they're not used to getting outside, and they're very fearful. And many times when a cat gets out, you're not getting them back. Secondly, have a plan for a natural disaster, just like, you know, a person would. You know, you may have some water stored in your basement, or a few canned goods, or, you know, things, supplies, candles, water, batteries, matches, candles, all of those things. Hey, why not store some dog food? Or, you know, store some water for them, leash, collar, bowls, something you can quick grab and take with you. Write down medications that your pets are on so that you've got your medication list and dosages and things like that to be able to take with you. Dogs should be on heartworm prevention year-round in areas where that's prevalent. And most heartworm preventatives now give the extra bonus of helping prevent internal parasites. These are the worms that live inside your dog, roundworms, hookworms, whipworms. A couple of those are the zoonotic kind, so we can get them from our dogs and our cats. And it's not just veterinarians who are talking about good parasite control for these zoonotic diseases. It's the Center for Disease Control. It's the Companion Animal Parasite Council. And veterinarians, because we just see it every day, especially families who have children under the age of 12, because you're going to go pet Fluffy and then go eat your peanut butter and jelly sandwich without washing your hands. Maybe, maybe, maybe. And people who are on certain kind of medications that might be suppressing your immune system. So, chemotherapy, folks. Autoimmune disease, folks. If you have an immune system that's compromised, your pet needs to be on parasite protection year round because you don't have the immune system to fight that possible exposure yourself. Lastly, tick and flea control. I still hear people, well, I'm going to take them off over the winter. Don't. If you live in an area that has ticks, you need to be on good year-round flea and tick, whether it's, you know, a Seresto collar, whether it's a NexGard chew once a month, or one of the topicals, do it. Your veterinarian's not just trying to sell you stuff. Your veterinarian's trying to keep your pet and you healthy and safe.
Special thanks to Dr. Steva Stoll Hardcastle for sharing her expertise with us. If you want to learn more about pets and climate change, head over to the Citizens Climate blog. I have a ton of links that you can look at so that you can dig deeper into this topic. Visit citizensclimate.org/blog and look for episode 13 of our show. That's citizensclimate.org/blog. Now it is time for the Art House. Carrying on with the theme of pets, I did some research into the pet industry. They are always looking ahead to consider market trends. Lately, pet industry researchers have been considering climate change and how it will affect pet ownership. In the following monologue, I weave in some of their findings with a little of my own musings. This next piece is set in the future, the year 2167, 150 years from now. Climate historian Timothy Meadows looks back to consider pets in a time of climate change. And in so doing, we will discover the pets of the future.
I am Timothy Meadows. It is Friday, June 26, 2167, and time for that day in climate history. By the year 2026, the human population exceeded 8 billion people. Dog and cat populations also exploded. In the US alone, the number of dog and cat pets reached over 200 million. Many of these were overfed and dangerously overweight. With the growing droughts and disruption in grain and meat production during the 2020s, the cost of pet care grew dramatically. While pets provided companionship and entertainment, many people found they simply could not afford to keep a dog or cat in their homes. As a result, pets got smaller. Large dogs consumed too much, so for a time smaller breeds became popular. Also, people began to opt for more practical pets, ones that also provided food. Chickens can be surprisingly friendly and social. They became the rage in suburbs and even in cities where their owners benefited from the eggs the chickens produced. Guinea pigs, a delicacy in Ecuador and Peru, became popular in North America. The guinea pig was an inexpensive pet that could provide a meal in a pinch. By 2035, pet sharing became common. Much like communities share vehicles through services like Communicar, pet sharing services abounded in North America, Australia, and Europe. Animal lovers spent time with a dog or a cat for a few hours a week without the expense of pet ownership. By 2075, historians note a dramatic decrease in the public interest in pets. Humans lived in closer-knit communities with more social cohesion, active friendly collectives, and shared spaces. As a result, people found their need for companionship met through friendship with other humans. On this day in 2167, we remember that day in climate history.
If you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. That email address, radio@citizensclimate.org. Before we end our show, let's look at last month's puzzler and hear the new puzzler question. Last month, the question had to do with Arctic warming. Your Uncle Jim cornered you at a family gathering. He knows you're a climate advocate and asked, "What's the big deal with melting glaciers? It seems everything I read about climate change, they're freaking out about these glaciers. Why the obsession?" Well, thanks for all the answers you sent. Eve Simmons from Cardiff by the Sea in California left the following message.
Hi, Peterson. In response to Uncle Jim's query, well, Uncle Jim, that's a great question, melting glaciers. One of the reasons I work on climate is because all those glaciers are expected to melt by 2050. And I know over 1 billion people depend on that mountain glacier melt for their yearly source of water. So that means to cook with and clean and drink and grow crops. That's a lot of human suffering. 1 in 7 people without access to clean, safe water. So I'd like to see us all have that right, clean, safe water. So I'm building political will for a livable world.
Thank you, Eve, and thanks to everyone who responded to the puzzler. So, are you ready for our new puzzler? It's about food. People love talking about food. Well, at least I do. Every climate advocate does well to have some info about climate change effects on our favorite foods. So here is your puzzler question. What is a food you'd love that is affected by climate change? And exactly how is global warming threatening it? I'll repeat the question. What is a food you love that is affected by climate change? And exactly how is global warming threatening this food? Send me your answers. Leave your name, contact information, and where you're from. Get back to me by July 15th, 2017. You can email these answers to me, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. You can also text me or leave a voicemail of 3 minutes or less at the following number, 570-483-8194. +1 if calling from outside the USA. That number again is 570-483-8194. We have reached the end of episode 13 of Citizens Climate Radio. The show is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. Technical support from Ricky Bradley. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Keck, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Para. All of the music we use on the show is licensed unless otherwise specified. Special music for the Art House segment includes one suite from the free 1920s collection on archive.org. Please be sure to share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. They actually may be quite interested in this pet episode. Just look for Citizens Climate Lobby wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at @CitizensCRadio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio, @CitizensCRadio. Visit citizensclimate.org/blog to find info about our puzzler and links to dig deeper. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.
Long time ago, before, again, good research was done on food, cats were dying of heart disease, cardiomyopathy. As they did more research, they realized that cats cannot make their own amino acid taurine. Taurine is found in meat. And so these pet foods were lacking taurine. And because they didn't realize that cats were different than dogs. Now all cat foods have the amino acid taurine added in, and although cats still can get heart disease, it's not a nutritional-based disease anymore. Mm-hmm.